remember thinking, like, those are really weird names. I mean, the Bible names are really weird to begin with. These are really, really strange names. And the story was just so striking. You know, they refuse to worship. They get thrown into the furnace, and they come out on the other side completely fine. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, we've been talking about how the book of Daniel is really about how hard it is to be a Christian. You know, here are these Jewish men who are taken into exile, these Jewish people, and the big question for them is, how can I live out my faith in the midst of this hostile environment? And so you have this perfect picture in here. You have three men who work for the king whose faith has now come under attack. They're either asked to set aside their faith or they're asked to renounce their faith, depending on how you view this. But they need to make a decision. You know, it kind of reminds me, of this old song that Kermit the Frog used to sing. You know, he used to sing this song, which he said, "It's not easy being green." It's not easy being a Christian. You know, there's a sense in which as Christians, in different ways, maybe not this way, we're time to time asked to put our faith aside. And it's difficult. I think one of the hardest things in our culture to be is it's hard to be a Christian. Obviously, I think it's much harder to be a Muslim today, but I think it's really hard to be a Christian. In a lot of avenues, in a lot of ways, we're asked to leave our faith on the side. We might not be asked to renounce our faith, but we're asked to leave our faith at the door. You know, that when we come into our place of work, that we step into a discussion on politics, that when it comes to being a good neighbor, a lot of times we're asked to leave our Christianity, our faith, aside. And the question that we have to ask is, how do we live faithfully in a world that continues to ask us to do that? How do we live our faith out in a place that seems so hostile to our beliefs, so hostile to the things that are important to us? And that's a difficult question. Like I said, in Daniel 3, we have this essentially kind of a Sunday school story, but it's also a very serious, very scary story. It's about three men who need to make a decision because they're being asked to push their faith to the side. So as we go through the sermon today, I actually wanted to construct it a little bit differently, and I wanted to answer a couple of questions. Essentially, what Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego realize, if they haven't already, is that living faith out in this community, in this place, in this time, living faith out means they have to live counterculturally. They cannot do what everyone else does. And I hope you've begun to realize that about the Christian life too. Being a Christian necessitates that you are not going to live the way everyone else does. And that makes sense. You know, if Christianity is that now that God is my king, Jesus is my savior, then if you have a different king, if you have a new king, then it means that your life changes. And so I hope you've come to realize that being a Christian means that you've been called to live in a countercultural way. And so basically, what I wanted to do is I wanted to answer three questions that we see them answer, three questions that we need to answer in order to live counterculturally. And these are the questions. First of all, first question is, what will keep you from bowing? Right? For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're commanded to bow before this idol. What will keep us from bowing before the idols of our society, the idols of our culture? Second question is, what will cause us, what will strengthen us, what will make us courageous to risk our lives? Because that's essentially what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do. They risk their lives. They have a decision of faith to make, and they make a decision, and it's very risky. Matter of fact, in their mind, it will lead to death. So what will help us to be courageous like that so that we are willing to risk our lives? And the third question is this. What will help us get through it alive? And I think that's a very important question. You know, what will help us survive whatever it is that we go through? Okay, so the first question is this. What will keep you from bowing down? If you go back into verses 4 through 7, I normally kind of read through it. I'm not going to read through it today because I'm kind of winded from reading through the whole thing. But essentially, we get to the point where Nebuchadnezzar has this idea. He builds this golden statue, and he commands the people everywhere, come and bow down and worship. Now, you know, I want to kind of explain this because it seems like a strange situation. I think in our culture, if any president, if any leader did that, we would know that something's vastly wrong, right? If Donald Trump came out tomorrow and said, I'm going to build a gold statue of myself, and you need to come here, and all the people of America need to bow down before it. I mean, we would know, we would instinctually know that's wrong, because people don't do that anymore. Back in the ancient Near East, this is what they all did. This was very common. Remember, for the pharaohs, when they became pharaohs, they would erect huge stone statues. They would erect monuments of themselves while they were still alive. And that kings would command people to come and to worship the image or to bow at their feet. So these things are very common. Now there's something going on here that I think you need to understand. I think the first is, in the ancient Near East, kings did see themselves as gods or godlike. And that's one of the reasons why they commanded worship. There's another thing going on that's equally important, which is this. The other thing happening is this was actually one of the ways, if you remember, Babylon had gone into Jerusalem, all the surrounding areas, and they'd essentially destroyed everything in Jerusalem, the temple, the city. They carried off these foreign people into exile. And one of the ways that you secured their allegiance, one of the ways in which you started shifting their allegiance from their old country to their new country, from their old king to their new king, was you made them do things like this. You made them bow and you made them essentially pledge allegiance to this new king, to this new country, to this new land. And that's kind of what's happening. It's you know, part of it is nationalistic in the sense that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar wants to pull in the Jews so that they feel like they're Babylonians and not Jews anymore. Another part is that it strikes this very serious note because he's asking Jewish people to bow and to worship this image, this quote-unquote other god. And immediately that attacks their faith. You know, you don't have to go very far in the commandments because the command to worship no other god before God is commandment number one. You don't have to get to the Ten Commandments and go, is it number seven? Is it number eight? Is it number nine? That's the first one on the list. I mean, this is a big deal. Nebuchadnezzar commands, he sends out a decree to everyone, gathers everyone, and he says, you must bow. You must worship this thing. And if you do not, then you will be punished. Not just punished, but you will be killed. And if you notice, there's no wiggle room. Immediately you begin to notice that there's lots of pressure on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, there's pressure from the power structures, from the king himself and the laws, the decrees. There's also societal pressure. Everyone else is doing it. Now, if you think about it for a second, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could have made excuses, and they could have rationalized it away, right? They could have said, you know what? I mean, even though I get down and I bow before this gold statue, I mean, God knows my heart, right? I mean, they could have rationalized it. They could have said, you know, God knows who I really love. I mean, I'm not really serious about that. I'm just getting down on my knee and it's no big deal. And I mean, God knows what's really going on inside. Right? They could have made excuses, or they could have made this excuse. I thought this one would be very rational. They could have said, you know what? If I don't do this, I'm dead. If I'm dead, I can't help my people. I mean, if this is one of the things that I have to do so that God can use me later on, then so be it. God knows. I mean, God understands that, right? And there's lots of different ways that they could have rationalized this away to say, well, I got to do what I got to do. I mean, they're the authority, and I'm just a peon under them, and whatever they say, I mean, God is the one who gives out authority, so if this is what I have to do, this is what I have to do. And there's a lot of ways they could have rationalized that away. But they don't. Now, what they realize is something very, very important is at stake, and they realize that they have no wiggle room. They realize that in order to do this, they really do need to put aside their religious convictions, their beliefs. And there's a lot of pressure on them. So the question is this: what kept them from bowing? Right? That's the first question. What kept them from bowing? Well, go to verse 4, and then we'll go to verse 7. And then I want to show you some other places that kind of pops up. But look at verse 4 for a second. And in verse 4, it says, "And the herald proclaimed aloud, 'You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up.'" You notice the end of that verse? They're to come to this image, and they're to worship this image, this thing, this statue that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. That's actually a very important phrase. You get down to verse 7, and the writer makes it very clear. You get to the, you look at the tail end of that verse. It says, "The peoples, nations, languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up." You go back to verse 3, the very end of that verse. It says that all the officials came, and they came down to this image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You go to verse 12. It says, "There are certain Jews who have whom you've appointed over the affairs of the provinces," da-da-da, go down to the end, "worship the golden image that you have set up." Go into verse 14. Verse 14, it says, "Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, 'It is true, you do not serve my gods, worship the golden image that I have set up.'" Go down into verse 18. Verse 18, you see it says the same thing. "But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve the gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." If you notice, there's something that the writer's trying to get across to us, isn't there? He's showing us the reason why they are unwilling to bow. Over and over again, we're reminded that this isn't a real God. This is just something that the king fashioned, that the king formed, that he set up. He said, "Worship this." And you know, it might not seem like a big deal, but the writer puts it in again and again and again. Matter of fact, within a very short span of time, that phrase comes up 6 different times out of the mouths of different people at different times for different reasons. But it's a reminder again and again and again of the fact that this is not a real God. This is just a statue. It's a thing that some person has put together and fashioned and formed and placed in this area, and he's telling you to worship it. What will keep you from, what kept them from worship? Well, what kept them from bowing down was realizing that this isn't a real thing. That they were being asked to worship something that was not real and that was not true. And, you know, that sounds easy to say, but it's actually very difficult. For you and I, our idols aren't gold statues. Our society has different idols. Our society makes idols of things like money, pleasure, power, security, self-image, beauty. You know, our culture doesn't set up these huge monuments that are casting gold that everyone can see. Our culture sets up hidden idols. But we see the monuments for that too, don't we? You go onto someone's Instagram feed and all it's about is beauty. Pictures from different angles, glamour shots, all to accentuate, all to highlight beauty. Or you go into the workplace, and immediately within a few minutes, you begin to realize what the idol is. It's money, for whatever that can be, greed. And you begin to talk to people, and their lives are driven by it. Their lives are directed by it. Their lives are worked out to excruciating detail because of it. That they make choices, that they make decisions, that everything is based around that, that some people will even marry not for love, but for money. You see, our idols aren't as overt. They aren't as obvious. But what kept them from bowing down is what will keep you from bowing down. What kept them from bowing down was this reminder again and again and again that this is not real. This is not true. And you know, for you and I, the idols are hidden, but that's what will keep us from bowing to our idols, is reminding ourselves, telling ourselves, and really believing that our idols aren't true either. That they promise things that sound real, that sound wonderful, that sound good, that even seem attainable, that some people say, yeah, it works. But what will keep us from bowing down is this reminder that they are not real. And you know, we see that happening, right? I mean, sure, you get some people who can go on Instagram and they take beautiful pictures of themselves and they rack up followers, they begin to monetize their feed, and they live off of this vast sum of money that's coming into them constantly. Matter of fact, I didn't know this was a thing, but advertisers can, you know, pay Instagram people to simply take shots of themselves with their product right next to them. And they don't have to hold it smiling like, ding, you know, that I'm advertising this. It can simply be sitting in the background. They can take some pictures of themselves, and in comes a big fat check. It's interesting because we're getting to the point now where people are coming out of that phase saying, you know, all of that's fake. People who have spent years of their lives building up wealth and taking pictures of themselves have been coming out saying, you know, it's not what you think it is. It's false. Matter of fact, I think I've shared this a couple weeks ago, but I was reading a little article by this woman who had gained a huge following on Instagram, and she basically said in order to take one picture that she puts on there, it takes her hours upon hours. And she realized that she didn't want to give the image anymore that beauty was all that mattered and that simply you take a picture of yourself and everyone clamors and you make money. She wanted to let younger women know, girls know, that it doesn't look like that. That as nice and shiny and glossy as the picture is, that's not really what it's like. That's not life. That's not the way the body really looks. And that there's a lot of falseness to it. You know, for us, the thing that keeps us from bowing at all the idols that we have around us is reminding ourselves that they aren't true. And they scream at us that they work. We see people who make lots of money and it seems to make their lives easier. And the thing that will keep you from bowing at the altar of money or beauty or security or any of these things, pleasure, power, reputation, is this conviction and this belief that they are not true. They can work for a while, but there's a huge difference between what works and what is real. What is lasting and what is true. And that's the way we protect ourselves. We protect ourselves with doctrine. We protect ourselves with knowing what's right. We protect ourselves with knowing the God who really is. You know, there's an idol in our culture, I think in our circles that we usually don't talk about that has a very powerful effect also, and that's education, right? The idol of education. That's the idol that my parents worshipped at. That's the one that I sometimes struggle with. And the idol of education says, if you can get a college degree, if you can have a good job, your life is set. Right? Have your parents ever told you that one? Study hard, do well on your SATs, get into a good college. The better college you get into, the better career you have, the better career you have, the better things are going to go for you. And for a little while, you believe it. But it's not true, absolutely not true. Matter of fact, now that I'm on this side of the education swing, now that I have kids, now that I'm older and I have friends who've gone through kids and those types of things, I begin to realize that people who have great educations, who have great jobs, who are making, you know, tons of money, some of them are incredibly unhappy, that education hasn't done much for them at all. That they might be comfortable, but their life is not at peace. They might have what they want, but they do not have what they need. And again, the only way we deal with these idols, the only way we keep ourselves from bowing is by telling ourselves, reminding ourselves of what is true. And again, that's a very powerful thing for Daniel, you know, for his friends. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're constantly told, worship at the idol of this, bow down, do this, and it'll be all okay. And again, they remind themselves, this is not real, this is not true. Second question we have is this. What will cause you to risk your life? Let's go to verse 12, and I want to read a little section for you. Starting in verse 12, it says, there are certain Jews whom you've appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Now, if you notice, Nebuchadnezzar has given them a test, essentially a test of loyalty. And again, these three men know exactly what that means. If they obey, if they do what the king wants them to do, then they're fine. If they do not, then they're going to die. And despite that, if you notice, what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego decide to do is they decide that they are going to obey God and not Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I want you to notice this, and I think this is something that doesn't come across in the Sunday school delivery of this story. The story is actually not about deliverance. Right? The story is not about God delivering them. The crux of the story is about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's radical obedience. Right? That's the decision that has to be made. The crux of the story is really around, what are these men going to do? They found out, they know what the consequences are going to be. You know, they obey, fine, but they are disobeying God. They can obey God and then possibly, most likely, give up their lives. What are they going to do? And the story ultimately is not about deliverance. It's about obedience. It's about radical obedience. In other words, you have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they are willing to obey even if it means death. You want a good definition of spiritual courage? This is a good definition of spiritual courage. You know, you're faced with a decision where the decision one way means life, the other way means death, and you choose the way that means physical death. I mean, that's courageous. It's one of those things that, like, when I was younger, I used to imagine going out on missions and, you know, what would happen if I was told to renounce my faith or else I would be, and, you know, like, As someone who wanted to be a hero, I'd say, oh, of course I would, you know, I would never renounce my faith. But in the secret of my heart, I go, yeah, I don't know what would happen. You know, I don't know how to handle that. And hopefully it's nothing that any of us ever have to deal with. But I want you to listen to their answer, because this is the reason why they were able to risk their lives. In verse 16, it says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Now, I want you to notice something. The reason why they are willing to risk their lives is because they believe that God can save them. Right? That's it's about the power of God. You know, they believe that God can rescue them. But they also understand that this could lead to death. And matter of fact, I'll share this with you. Most of us don't think about it this way. But when it comes to obedience, especially when it comes to obedience, to God, obedience always leads to death of some kind. And I know that's a weird statement to make, right? Obedience leads to death of some kind. You know, one of the things that parents do, that I do as a parent, is there are times where we ask our kids to obey. You know, for our kids, I don't want to embarrass any one of them in particular, so I'm going to try to use this illustration in a very generic way so that you can't tell who it is. But I was talking to my son, and no, I'm kidding. I'm not going to do that to him. I'm just kidding. I would never do that to my son. But you know, when a parent asks a child to obey, obedience is death, right? I mean, think about it for a second. You know, you go to your child, you go to someone, and you say, can you do this for me? And sometimes you don't use can, right? As parents, you just say, do this for me, right? It doesn't come off as nicely, but you say, do this. Now, for the child, there's a decision to make. And it's a genuine decision. They have to kind of go through it. but they don't want to always do the things that they're asked to do. Why? Because it means death. And they know that, right? If I obey my parent, then I can't do what I want to do. That's death. That's death. It's dying to myself or dying to my plans or dying to the things that I want to do, dying to my pleasures, and instead choosing to do this other thing that I don't want to do, that I don't need to do for myself, or that isn't good for me, or that I don't believe is good for me. But every time there is a decision of obedience, death is required. Death is a part of it. You know, when I choose to obey someone, my boss, for instance, sure, it could mean that I'm fired, but every time I make that decision, there's death involved. I'm dying to myself. I'm dying to my plans. I'm dying to my greeds. I'm dying to my pleasures. I'm dying to my reputation. You know, every decision, obedience always leads to death of some kind. You know, it always leads to death of some kind. And again, it doesn't mean that we're going to die in that, but it means that obedience is never easy. Obedience is never easy. If obedience was easy, then all of us would do it, and it would not be a big deal anymore. But the truth is that obedience is hard because it means death. It means that I lay to rest my desires, I lay to rest my plans, I lay to rest my dreams, my hopes, I lay to rest my temporal things, but it always means a death of some type. And the question is this. The question is, what makes you courageous like that? What makes you courageous to be ready to take on death? Whether it's physical death or whether it's some other kind of death. Well, again, here, what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego access or what they use is the power of God. They believe that it's the power of God that can rescue them. They know it might not happen, but they believe it can and they believe it will. Now, let me explain this, and this is going to be kind of a shift for a lot of you. For you and I, it's slightly different. You know, for you and I, we live in the New Testament age. In other words, we live after Jesus. And the interesting thing that happens is, on this side, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the thing that made them courageous is the power of God, right? And they could think of power encounters with God all the way through the Old Testament. They could remember the times where God parted the Red Seas. They could remember the time where God parted the Jordan River. They could remember the time where God came flashing down like lightning. They could remember the times when God ripped open the earth and swallowed up those who disobeyed. They could remember the times where the people of God would go up to a city and the city would fall before them without them doing a thing. Now, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it made sense. They thought about the power of God. But for you and I, it's slightly different, and it's different because of this. From the gospel accounts on, we find out what the true power of God is. And the true power of God is not the right hand and the might of God. The true power of God, according to Jesus and everything that Jesus did, is the love of God, the grace of God, and the mercy of God. I want to get you to turn to a different place. If you have a physical Bible, which I don't know how many of you do, you can keep your hand in Daniel 3. But I want you to flip out to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. It's right at the end of the New Testament. If you've got to Revelation, you went a little bit too far. And I want you to listen to 1 John chapter 4. Verses 7 and 8. God calls his people to love, and I want you to listen to the reason why or the foundational thing that he says. 1 John chapter 4, starting in verse 7, he says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God," and listen to this, "because God is love." Now, the reason why that's such an important statement, it isn't just that John is using bad grammar and he happens to mix up an adverb and an adjective and he says, you know, God is love instead of God is loving. you know, what's going on is he's telling us something. He's telling us about this slight shift. He's telling us that God has lots of characteristics: power, justice, mercy, compassion, long-suffering, faithfulness, you know, all these things. But he's saying, but the one thing that characterizes God above everything else is love. In other words, love is the guiding thing about God that makes everything else about him the way that it is. In other words, if you were to boil everything down about God, John would say that the thing you could boil it down into is love. And again, you know, you could say, well, that's weird. You know, how is power and love, those things don't even equate. In Jesus, they do. You know, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the thing that made them courageous and the thing that made them strong was that God could stick his right hand down, he could grab a hold of them, and he could pull them out of the fiery furnace unscathed. And that's what God essentially does. And in doing that, they would be delivered. For you and I, we know that the true power of God may or may not be deliverance like that. We know that there's a greater power at work. We know that the greater power is love, that when you know that you are loved by God, that makes you infinitely more courageous. It makes you courageous in the midst of possibly losing your job, possibly losing your friends, possibly losing a sense of security, a strength in your life, possibly losing something that you consider to be so dear and near and dear to you that you would never think about giving it up. And yet, the thing that would make you strong and courageous, willing to risk even those things in your life, is knowing the love of God. And when you truly know the love of God, you find yourself being courageous in the face of any idol. That when you know the love of God, you're willing to forsake everything else if it means having this. And you see, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it was the power of God. It was God can come down and deliver me. But after Jesus has come, it's God has delivered me. And the way that I know that God has delivered me is through the cross, through the resurrection. That Jesus has won my heart, and that that my life belongs to him. And if that's true, I can give up anything. I can go to the farthest off land. I can give up anything that I consider to be dear to me, and I can risk it all because he has my heart, because he has me. And that's a radical thing. That's a very important shift. What makes us courageous now is not the power, it's the love of God in our lives. Third question that I wanted to ask, and we'll do this relatively quickly, is what will get you through it alive? When you go to verse 19, we see that they are thrown into the furnace. They walk through it. I don't really know like what they do. You know, Nebuchadnezzar looks down and he says, wow, I see four men, not three. I don't know if they looked up and said, hey, Nebuchadnezzar, look, we're fine. You know, and they're called out and they don't even smell of smoke. The story ends and it tells us something about what we need to get through it alive. One of the unique things about this story is it's not about one man. It's about three. And that's actually a very important thing. My guess is, and the funny thing is you never hear about any of these men by themselves. You don't hear about Shadrach doing something great and, you know, he's in this part of Daniel and Meshach doing something else and Abednego doing something else. It seems like they're all joined at the hip. You know, the story always kind of connects these three men. And in this case, it's an important part of the story. Now, here are three men who have to make a very difficult decision. And in a lot of ways, they find the strength to make it because they're together, because they're not going to go it alone. And when you think about that, that's a very important quality. I mean, think about what happens when you're with a group of people like that. Well, I mean, there's times where if you ever had to make a decision like that, there are times where you by yourself might falter, right? So what do you need in those times? Well, you need someone who doesn't have the same foible as you, who when you feel weak, they're strong. And when they feel weak, you're strong. And to some degree, I kind of believe that's what's happening here. It's not an accident that you have three men facing this daunting challenge together, three men who have made the same countercultural decision that they are not going to listen to the king, that they're going to live in this other way that puts their life in danger, and that they make it through that way. You know that in some ways the story is about friendship, it's about fellowship, and it shows us going forward the need for fellowship, the need for church. Matter of fact, when you get into the New Testament, you begin to find out how important people are to our spiritual life. We begin to find out through the gospel accounts and then through the epistles, we begin to find out that we were not meant to go it alone. We begin to find out that you and I as believers were never meant to be left on our own. That when we are left alone to our own devices, there's no number of things that we can find ourselves falling into, being distorted by, tempted by, challenged by, and that in a lot of ways, God has designed us to find strength, to find fellowship, to find courage together, and that together as one body, as one people, as one church, we eliminate our weaknesses. We make each other strong. Together we make it through whatever the world has to throw at us. I mean, that happens in marriage, right? I mean, in a good marriage, you don't become weaker because at times you have to deal with someone else and someone else has to deal with you. And I mean, sure, there are times sins multiply, but in marriage, you become stronger. In a family, you become stronger. And if, you know, with a family, you can withstand the challenges that come from the outside sometimes because there's other people to lean on. And it's the same thing for our church. God puts us in places like this with people like this because there are times where living our lives in this world, we will feel and be weak. And one of the things that we need is we need someone around who can be strong when we are weak. And what we need is we need to be strong when others feel weak too. And my guess is if you've been a believer for a while, you've experienced that before. You've experienced a time where you've been down spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically. And the thing that got you through it, the thing that pushed you through that hump, the thing that made you last was a friend, a Christian friend. And maybe it wasn't even someone who came up to you. You could find out years later that someone was praying for you. And you look back and you see how much those prayers meant. But you and I cannot go it alone. That when we try, everything crumbles around us. Now, that's not entirely true. I had to say that, and I have to tell you it's not entirely true either. It is true that we need friends. It is true that we need community. It is true that we need the church. And the reason why is because with friends, you know, we find strength in their strength. We find things in them that we don't have. The stronger they are, the more they help us, those types of things. Ultimately, the story isn't just about friends. It's about the one friend that truly matters. You know, when you get to the end of the story, what is it? Well, we find out what it is. If you go to verse 24, 25, it says, King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? And they answered and they said to him, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. You know, ultimately, what the story points us to is the fact that the true friend that all of us need that will get us through is Jesus. That he is the one friend that even when all other friends forsake us, he is the one friend who will be there. You know, it's tempting to read the story and to think that Jesus just kind of appeared, you know, when these men were thrown into the fire. I tend to believe, and I want to believe, that he was there all along. He just showed up in the fire. You know, that when the fire was there and they were thrown in, this fourth man appeared, but that he was really with them all the time. I mean, that's how God works in our lives, isn't it? We go through suffering, we don't see him, but we get to the worst, and when he appears, it's not, oh, God, glad you showed up. We realize he's always been there. But you see, he's the one friend that we truly need. We need friends, we need people around us, we need a church. But ultimately, the friend that we truly need is we need Christ. The one who truly loves us, the one who in his strength, we find our strength. The one who in his love, in his character, in his commitment, carries us through in our weaknesses. And the way that we know that he will walk with us through our worst experiences is that Jesus went through a terrible experience for us. Jesus went to the cross and he gave up his life. All of his friends ran away, all of his friends left, and in his moment of need, he was all by himself. Why? Because that's what you and I deserve. You and I deserve to be deserted by every friend, by anyone who ever, you know, said they knew us. But on the cross, Jesus also promises that he will be the one that stays true. Because he knows what it's like to be left. And when you believe in God, when you believe in Jesus like that, then when your fiery furnace comes, when your trouble comes, when you are persecuted, when you have to make very difficult decisions, he is the one that when, if you know he is there, you can go through any storm, any fire, any difficulty, any trouble, any heartache, any problem, anything. Let's pray together. And Father, we do thank you again for this wonderful account of three men who stood against the grain, who decided to risk their lives, to even lose their lives for the sake of obeying you. And Lord, as much as we want to honor them, we realize that there is another man we are truly meant to honor, that Jesus did the same too, but much worse. That Jesus didn't just risk his life, he gave his life knowingly, willingly, voluntarily, not just in obedience to a law or a command, but because he knew that in giving his life, he would win ours. So Father, we want to thank you for all that you've done for us, that you've sent your son Jesus to come to live in our shoes, to die in our place, and to win our lives back to you, and that through his life, our lives make sense. And Lord, because of what Jesus did, help us to live our lives, to make choices that are necessarily countercultural. Because the world will ask us to push our faith to the side. The world will ask us to set aside our beliefs, our convictions, our moral code. Lord, whenever that happens, whatever that may mean, pray that you show us that it is always worth living for you. Lord, I pray for the friends that I know and for the people that I know who have lost jobs over religious convictions. Pray for those who have lost standing and their place in society because of their belief in you. And I pray for all those who've come before us who've lost their lives because they wanted to profess Jesus. And I pray that as a living universal church, that we too can take the call to live and to use our lives for the glory of God. So show us when we need to stand up for our faith. Show us when we need to risk ourselves. And show us, Lord, how to rest on you, how to trust in you, and how to see that with you we have all that we need. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.